Hello, and welcome to the Best of Science World. Today we'll feature some of the most interesting conversations we've had on our program's one-on-one segments. We'll hear about one of the most violent volcanic eruptions of all time, how there may be oceans of water deep inside the Earth, learn about an amazing new device that is giving hope to those who are unable to move their limbs, and we'll hear from a scientist who says he has found evidence that Mars may have actually been habitable several billion years ago. So stay with us for this special edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. While you may have heard about the eruptions of the Krakatoa, Mount Pinatubo, and Mount Vesuvius volcanoes, you probably haven't heard much about the eruption of Indonesia's Mount Tambora in 1815. Yet this 19th century volcanic eruption was one of the most violent eruptions in thousands of years and is said to have had a wide-ranging impact on the world. Gillan Darcy Wood, the author of Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World, talked with us about the eruption of this volcano and the incredible impact it had on humanity. Why do you think we haven't heard much about the Mount Tambora eruption?
Well, I think there are a couple of good reasons that we know very little about Tambora until now. It mostly has to do with communications. The destruction of Pompeii in AD 79 was memorialized by the famous Roman writer Pliny the Younger, who gave an unforgettable description of the eruption of Vesuvius. And then the other eruptions, such as Krakatoa and Mount St. Helens and Pinatubo, all occurred since the advent of modern communications. Tambora didn't enjoy any of those benefits, and exploded on a remote island in the Dutch East Indies, as it was then, and now Indonesia, in 1815, in the age of steamships, when the news of such an event could take months to travel back to Europe or North America.
Professor, can you take us back to the spring of 1815 and the eruption of Mount Tambora?
Mount Tambora is located on an island just to the east of Bali in Indonesia. It commands an entire peninsula and had been dormant for probably thousands of years before April of 1815, when it began to rumble and spring to life. There was a considerable eruption on April the 5th of 1815, and the inhabitants of the island of Sumbawa took fright at this first eruption. But they thought that it was possibly over with and had returned to harvesting their rice and grooming their stock of horses, for which the island was very famous. But 5 days later, on April the 10th, 1815, the largest volcanic explosion on Earth for possibly thousands of years occurred. And the entire peninsula, certainly the human population of that whole peninsula, was destroyed within hours, and darkness descended across all of Southeast Asia for a couple of days. Ash was found 3,000 kilometers away. Governments everywhere across the whole region sent out their navies, thinking that they were under attack from pirates. The reverberations from the volcano were so thunderous.
Now, when Mount Tambora erupted in 1815, the world was already in what has been described as the Little Ice Age since the late 13th century. Now, how much did this Indonesian eruption further affect climate?
It had a profound effect over a 3 to 5 year period. It cooled the climate, which is the impact of a major volcanic eruption in the tropics. Its effect upon the atmosphere is to create a kind of blanket and or a shield which reflects the rays of the sun back into space. The 1810s, thanks to Tambora and another major volcano that erupted in 1809, the 1810s has a claim to be the coldest decade of the last millennium. The Little Ice Age had been kind of intermittent 6th-century cold snap since the 1300s, had made life in Europe and North America quite difficult. The 1810s, of all of that entire 6th-century period, the 1810s is in fact the coldest thanks to Tambora. But this fact, this environmental or climatic fact of the deep cold, the deep freeze of the 1810s, has been little noticed by historians until now. Of course, now in the 21st century, we're much more interested in the relationship between climate and human affairs, and this has drawn our attention back toward looking at pivotal times in history, including the 1810s, and the impact that climate has on human history.
Why was 1816 considered to be the year without summer?
The first summer after a major tropical eruption will be the season most affected by climate deterioration. And this is because global cooling, instigated by a volcanic eruption, will drastically shorten the growing season available to farmers in the summer after the eruption. So you see radically shortened growing seasons all across the globe, from China to India to New England to Western Europe. Farmers have suffering under a kind of under a haywire climate regime where they simply do not have enough time to grow their crops. It's too cold. Either that, or their crops are starved of rain or washed away by floods. You have a series of kind of extreme weather events that mean that there's not enough food is produced. And in 1815, most of the world's inhabitants were relied upon subsistence farming. So you can imagine the consequences for communities across the globe when the usual output of food is not available in 1816. And this on top of already a number of years of poor harvests during the 1810s.
That was Gillan Darcy Wood from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and author of the book Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World.
This is the best of Science World on VOA.
Steve Jacobson, a geophysicist from Northwestern University, along with University of New Mexico seismologist Brandon Schmant, recently reported some new evidence that indicates that there are possibly oceans worth of water deep, deep, deep beneath the surface of the Earth. Dr. Jacobson joins us to talk about the research he and his colleague conducted and the possible huge water supply that lies deep beneath us. Now, when you're talking about the mantle, I realize it's one of the layers of the structure of Earth. What is the mantle exactly?
The crust of the Earth extends down to about 40 or 50 kilometers depth, so maybe 25 miles. And the difference between the crust and the mantle is compositional, so the rocks in the crust are a little different from the rocks in the mantle. We have some idea of what the rocks in the mantle are like from samples brought up by volcanoes. However, I should note that the deepest hole ever drilled in the crust is probably around 10 or 12 kilometers depth, so maybe 6 miles. And the mantle extends all the way down to the core mantle boundary, which occurs at about 3,000 kilometers depth. So the mantle makes up a huge amount of the planet. About half the planet's mass is in the mantle, which is a rocky silicate layer that is, for the most part, solid, except for a few places, like in this layer that my colleague Brandon Schmant and I have been studying, where we found evidence for a small amount of magma generation at that depth, at 400 miles depth.
What is the link, then, between magma generation and this water?
We're trying to connect the rock cycle, which some people know as plate tectonics, with the water cycle. Now, we know in the uppermost mantle and the crust. The crust and the mantle are interacting through plate tectonics. For example, the ocean crust contains hydrous minerals, both in the form of sediments on top, but also the ocean crust itself, which is largely made up of a rock that we call basalt, can become hydrated through interaction with seawater. In places where plates are coming together, one plate sometimes dives down into the mantle beneath the other. This is a process that we call subduction. And in subduction, water is taken down in the form of minerals, and they typically don't make it very far. Within the upper 100 kilometers or so of the mantle, the temperatures become so high and the pressures become high enough that those hydrous minerals begin breaking down to form other minerals, but in doing so, they also release some H2O. And it's actually the source of magma in all of the volcanoes you would see. So this is the upper mantle water cycle, and we wanted to ask the question of how much deeper could this H2O cycle extend into the mantle.
When you're hearing news about that there are oceans of water found deep inside the Earth, you have this visual image of huge masses of water. But from what I understand from what you're describing, Steve, is that it's not in a liquid or an ice or even a vapor form. So what form is it in?
The water is dissolved into the solid rock in the form of hydroxyl, which is an OH group. It's locked up in the minerals in this way. However, I should note that by having the components of water inside of rock at this depth of the Earth, it's very significant. It's connected to the oceans and the surface reservoirs through plate tectonics. So if you were able to bring up one of these rocks from the deep mantle, from 400 miles depth, and melt it near the surface, the OH would regroup and form water molecules and come out of a volcano in the form of water vapor. The source of water, if you will, in magma generation and eruptions, which release huge amounts of H2O and other volatiles like carbon dioxide. We think the deep water, the deep H2O, and surface reservoirs are connected. They're certainly connected in the shallow mantle. You know, you can probably recycle all of the water in the oceans through the upper mantle once every 100 million years or so, and that's just based upon current seafloor spreading rates. We don't know much yet about this deeper reservoir, which could be potentially as large as the oceans or maybe even more than that. We don't know how much of this water is part of that upper mantle cycle versus it being maybe somehow more isolated or trapped in this transition zone layer.
That was Steve Jacobson, a geophysicist at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Recently, a 23-year-old quadriplegic from Ohio was able to do something he hasn't been able to do for a long time, move his fingers and hands. With a new surgically implanted device called the NeuroBridge, the young man was able to do what many had long thought would be impossible just by using his own thoughts. Chad Booten, a research leader at Battelle, talks about the NeuroBridge and how it's giving new hope to those who are unable to move their arms and legs. This new device, NeuroBridge, what is it and what does it do?
Okay, the NeuroBridge system and technology is a way to take signals from the brain and actually specifically from neurons in the brain and route them around an injury, such as a spinal cord injury, and then relink those signals to the muscles of someone who's paralyzed. And the goal is to allow that person to be able to regain movement in the affected limb.
As you mentioned, the device bypasses the spinal cord and it sends signals from the brain to the actual muscles. Now, what led to this particular approach?
Well, so we had been working on the problem of decoding brain signals in folks that are paralyzed going back almost 10 years. And we thought, you know, we had some great success in working with other researchers in the area and doing things like controlling cursors on a computer and devices. But we thought we should be able to take the next step and allow someone who's disabled to actually regain movement in a limb that is paralyzed. And so we started to develop the system and the technology a few years ago to really take it to that next level.
So what is the patient that had the device implanted able to do now that he wasn't able to do before the implant?
The patient has been able to think about different wrist and hand movements and even finger movements, and he is able to actually open and close his hand, and we've also been able to have him hold an object and actually move that object and then let go of that object.
How does he do that?
Well, so it starts with training, and we call it basically virtual. We have a virtual hand on the screen, and he looks at that hand and thinks about different movements And then the hand, over time, starts to move in response to his brain activity. So we have developed special mathematical methods and software, or as we call algorithms, that learn his brain activity over time and then adapt and improve that feedback on the virtual hand on the screen. So the software gets better, the algorithms get better, and then Ian, or our patient, is able to get better over time as well and improve the performance.
So in other words, you're going from a visual cue, so you're taking input from the eye into the brain and making him think about moving his hand. So that's quite a bit of a jump.
Yes, yes it is. And we've learned how to adapt and improve the understanding of the brain activity, the language of the neurons, if you will. But we've also started to emulate the human spinal cord. So the spinal cord is not just a simple conduit of signals from the brain to the muscles. The spinal cord actually helps coordinate movements of the body. And if you think about walking, for example, your spinal cord is doing a tremendous amount of computation as you walk, and that's to allow your brain to think about other things. And so we're trying to figure out how to actually emulate those functions of the spinal cord, since we've bypassed it now with the NeuroBridge technology.
So please tell us what you and your team have learned since fitting the device on this young man.
We've learned a tremendous amount from a technical or technology standpoint, and we have learned how brain activity will change as someone, we're starting to learn how the brain activity will change as someone who's paralyzed begins to move again under their own thought patterns and their own control. Because this is really new, we're entering a new area, we're just learning a tremendous amount from that. And then really on a personal note, we've learned a tremendous amount from Ian, our patient, our first patient. He's just an amazing young man, and he has taught us a lot about how to really, move through life and deal with adversity. And he's done a tremendous job in the study, and his attitude and his focus and his overall enthusiasm is tremendous.
And finally, Chad, is the NeuroBridge a work that is still in progress, or has it been developed to where it's close to being released commercially?
Well, no, it's still under development. We are definitely in early stages as we continue to learn more. We will also need to refine the technology and develop further aspects to it over time. And then, of course, whenever you try to commercialize a medical technology, it does require additional studies and quite a bit of clinical data as well. So we don't know yet how long that will take, but we're certainly going to keep moving forward.
That was Chad Booten, a research leader at Battelle in Columbus, Ohio.
You're listening to The Best of Science World on The Voice of America.
Geologist Gregory Ratalik, who is also a professor at the University of Oregon, studied mineral and chemical data of some Martian soil and rocks that had been retrieved by the Curiosity rover and found that the material dated back to some 3.7 billion years ago. It also provided him with evidence that Mars was once, a long time ago, a much warmer and wetter planet. Professor Ratalik talks about his evidence that Mars may have been habitable several billion years ago. What first led you to look into some of the soil history of Mars?
I just sort of was really taken by some of the images that were coming back. They looked like buried soils, which is my specialty. And seeing is believing, of course, but they parked at this outcrop where I thought the buried soil was, and they drilled holes in it, and they made analyses. And when the data came in, we have ways of presenting that data that just nailed it, and it was really kind of thrilling for me. The team that was working with the rover didn't recognize it as a paleosol. They dismissed that interpretation, and they didn't discuss it in their published paper. And I was a bit miffed by that at first, but then I realized, oh my goodness, now that they've published all the data, they've given me this fantastic gift.
Paleosol. You mentioned paleosol. What is that?
A paleosol is a buried soil. So it's a soil that formed at some time in the past, and then it was covered up by sediment, like a flood deposit or a landslide or a lava flow. And then it pretty much as a part of the rock record from then on. We can use those soils to interpret what environments were like in the distant geological past.
How did Curiosity's data and imagery reveal the evidence you were looking for that Mars was warmer and wetter early in its history?
Well, what it showed very clearly was that the most common kind of weathering reaction we have on Earth, which is called hydrolysis, where you make clay out of feldspar and olivine, actually happened on Mars as well.
You also drew a comparison of Mars soil with that found at Earth's Antarctic dry valleys in Chile's Atacama Desert. Could you explain that?
There are lots of different sorts of fossil soils on Earth and lots of different modern soils, and we know quite a bit of how soils form. The soil that we found on Mars, buried in this 3.7 billion year old crater, are very shallow, and they're full of a mineral called gypsum, which is the material we make plaster of Paris and drywall from. And these sorts of soils are best known on Earth from extremely arid or cold environments like the dry valleys of Antarctica and the Atacama Desert. It's a very low productivity environment with only a few very, very hardy kinds of microbes. So if these Martian soils were alive, they were barely puttering along like they do in some of the most barren places on Earth.
You draw sort of a comparison, and I guess it must have been interesting to study and compare the various layers of Martian soil and rock with the new samples that are quite different than the older layers deep beneath it. Could you provide us a bit of a comparison between what we see in the newer rocks and soil samples on Mars versus the much older samples?
Yeah, the Viking landers of 1976, remember them? Carl
mm-hmm.
Sagan was involved in them. It seems like such a long time ago. We had quite good images, and we scooped around those landers, and we have a bit of an idea about what the soil is like in those spots. Those soils were very interesting indeed, because they're about 3 billion years old, not 3.7 or so, and those soils are very old themselves. Even though they're at the surface, those soils have so much clay and so much alteration in them that we don't think that they could form on Mars as it is currently. We think that those are fossil soils in the sense that they are relict, that they are remaining from soil-forming conditions that no longer exist. And this suggests that sometime between about 3.7 and 3 billion years, Mars, if it was ever alive, was dying and drying and getting colder with the development of the current cold climate on Mars.
You indicate in your research that, again, Mars was much warmer and wetter back in 3.7 billion years ago. How warm, how wet was the planet?
Well, at 3.7, we see Mars as being something like Greenland or Antarctica. But that's a lot warmer than it is now.
While your studies didn't really conclude that Mars may have once contained life, the environmental conditions suggested by your findings do indicate that the red planet was more habitable than the planet it has been in the past 3 billion years.
Exactly. And we also think that it's possible that there are even more habitable soils in some of the older terrains on Mars, which we're considering for future missions. Now, we want to know, for example, how long it took the planet to become from barely habitable, which is how I would describe the fossil soil that I was working on, to pretty inhospitable. And so that'll be interesting. We'll find quite a bit more about that, I think, as the months go on.
That was Dr. Gregory Ratalik, a geologist and a professor at the University of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon. That about does it for this edition of our show, and it saddens me to say that this was also the final edition of the Science World Radio program. While the program is ending, you'll still be able to hear me on the air as I report on and talk about the latest science news on VOA's International Edition. Also, our Science World blog will continue on the internet. The web address is voanews.com/science. There, you'll find stories about science, links, and much more. Again, the address is voanews.com/science. I've really enjoyed my 5 years of bringing you the latest in science, health, and technology every week on our radio program, and I do thank you so very much for tuning in. This is Rick Pantaleo, And this has been VOA's Science World.